Chapter 20. But he did not have time, or perhaps did not receive a pressing invitation until he had returned with his MS from California. Then, through young Charles Langdon, his Quaker City shipmate, he was invited to Elmira. The invitation was given for a week, but through a subterfuge unpremeditated, and certainly fair enough in a matter of love, he was enabled to considerably prolong his visit. By the end of his stay he had become really like one of the family, though certainly not yet accepted as such. The fragmentary letter that follows reflects something of his pleasant situation. The Mrs. Fairbanks mentioned in this letter had been something more than a hip mother to Mark Twain. She was a woman of fine literary taste, and Quaker City correspondent for her husband's paper, the Cleveland Herald. As he had given Mark Twain sound advice as to his letters, which he had usually read to her, and had in no small degree modified his early natural tendency to exaggeration and outlandish humor. He owed her much, and never failed to pay her tribute. Part of a letter to Mrs. Jane Clemens and family, in St. Louis. Elmira, N. YY August 26, 1868. Dear folks, you see I am progressing though slowly. I shall be here a week, yet maybe two, for Charlie Langdon cannot get away until his father's chief businessman returns from a journey, and a visit to Mrs. Fairbanks at Cleveland would lose half its pleasure if Charlie were not along. Moulton of St. Louis ought to be there too. We three were Mrs. F.'s ups in the Quaker City. She took good care that we were at church regularly on Sundays, at the 8 bells, prayer meeting every night, and she kept our buttons sewed on, and our clothing in order, and in a word was as busy and considerate, and as watchful over her family of uncouth and unruly cubs, and as patient, and as long-suffering, withal, as a natural mother. So we expect, August 25th. Didn't finish yesterday. Something called me away. I am most comfortably situated here. This is the pleasantest family I ever knew. I only have one trouble, and that is they give me too much thought, and too much time and invention to the object of making my visit pass delightfully. It needs, just how and when he left the Langdon home the letters do not record. Early that fall he began a lecture engagement with James Redpath, proprietor of the Boston Lyceum Bureau, and his engagements were often within reach of Elmira. He had a standing invitation now to the Langdon home, and the end of the week often found him there. Yet when at last he proposed for the hand of Livy Langdon, the acceptance was by no means prompt. He was a favorite in the Langdon household, but his suitability as a husband for the frail and gentle daughter was questioned. However, he was carrying everything, just then, by storm. The largest houses everywhere were crowded to hear him. Papers spoke of him as the coming man of the age. People came to their doors to see him pass. There is but one letter of this period, but it gives us the picture. To Mrs. Jane Clemens and family, in St. Louis, Cleveland, November 20, 1868. Dear folks, I played against the Eastern favorite, Fanny Kemble, in Pittsburgh, last night. S. He had 200 in her house, and I had upwards of 1,500. All the seats were sold in a driving rainstorm, 3 days ago, as reserved seats at 25 cents extra, even those in the second and third tiers, and when the last seat was gone the box office had not been open more than 2 hours. When I reached the theater they were turning people away, and the house was crammed, 150 or 200 stood up, all the evening. I go to Elmira tonight. I am simply lecturing for societies, at $100 a pop. Dear Sam, it would be difficult for any family to refuse relationship with one whose star was so clearly ascending, especially when every inclination was in his favor, and the young lady herself encouraged his suit. A provisional engagement was presently made, but it was not finally ratified until February of the following year. Then in a letter from one of his lecture points he tells his people something of his happiness. to Mrs. Jane Clemens and family in St. Louis, Lockport, NY, February 27, 1868. Dear folks, I enclosed $20 for Ma. I thought I was getting ahead of her little assessments of $35 a month, but find I am falling behind with her instead, and have let her go without money. Well, I did not mean to do it. But you see, when people have been getting ready for months in a quiet way to get married, they are bound to grow stingy, and go to saving up money against that awful day, when it is sure to be needed. I am particularly anxious to place myself in a position where I can carry on my married life in good shape on my own hook, because I have paddled my own canoe so long that I could not be satisfied now to let anybody help me, and my proposed father-in-law is naturally so liberal that it would be just like him to want to give us a start in life. But I don't want it that way. I can start myself. I don't want any help. I can run this institution without any outside assistance, and I shall have a wife who will stand by me like a soldier through thick and thin, and never complain. She is only a little body, but as he hasn't her peer in Christendom. I gave her only a plain gold engagement ring, when fashion imperatively demands a $200 diamond one, and told her it was typical of her future lot, namely, that she would have to flourish on substantials rather than luxuries. But you see, I know the girl, she don't care anything about luxuries. She is a splendid girl. She spends no money but her usual year's allowance, and she spends nearly every cent of that on other people. She will be a good, sensible little wife, without any airs about her. I don't make intercession for her beforehand, and ask you to love her, for there isn't any use in that. You couldn't help it if you were to try. I warn you that whoever comes within the fatal influence of her beautiful nature is her willing slave forevermore. I take my affidavit on that statement. Her father and mother and brother embrace and pet her constantly, precisely as if she were a sweetheart instead of a blood relation. As he has unlimited power over her father, and yet she never uses it except to make him help people who stand in need of help. But if I get fairly started on the subject of my bride, I never shall get through, and so I will quit right here. I went to Elmira a little over a week ago, and stayed 4 days, and then had to go to New York on business. No further letters have been preserved until June, when he is in Elmira, and with his fiancée reading final proofs on the new book. They were having an idyllic good time, of course, but it was a useful time too, for Olivia Langdon had a keen and refined literary instinct, and The Innocents Abroad, as well as Mark Twain's other books, are better today for her influence. It has been stated that Mark Twain loved the lecture platform, but from his letters we see that even at this early date, when he was at the height of his first great vogue as a public entertainer, he had no love for platform life. Undoubtedly he rejoiced in the brief periods when he was actually before his audience and could play upon it with his master touch, but the dreary intermissions of travel and broken sleep were too heavy a price to pay. To Mrs. Jane Clemens and family, in St. Louis, Elmira, June 4, 1868, Dear folks, Livy sends you her love and loving good wishes, and I send you mine. The last 3 chapters of the book came tonight. We shall read it in the morning, and then, thank goodness, we are done. In 12 months, or rather I believe it is 14, I have earned just $80 by my pen, 2 little magazine squibs, and 1 newspaper letter altogether, the idlest, laziest 14 months I ever spent in my life. And in that time my absolute and necessary expenses have been scorchingly heavy, for I have now less than $3,600 in bank out of the $8,000 or $9,000 I have made during those months, lecturing. My expenses were something frightful during the winter. I feel ashamed of my idleness, and yet I have had really no inclination to do anything but court Livy. I haven't any other inclination yet. I have determined not to work as hard traveling anymore as I did last winter, and so I have resolved not to lecture outside of the 6 New England states next winter. My Western course would easily amount to $10,000, but I would rather make $2,000 or $3,000 in New England than submit again to so much wearing travel. I have promised to talk 10 nights for $1,000 in the state of New York, provided the places are close together. But after all, if I get located in a newspaper in a way to suit me, in the meantime, I don't want to lecture at all next winter, and probably shan't. I most cordially hate the lecture field. And after all, I shudder to think that I may never get out of it. In all conversations with Go and Anna Dickinson, Nasby, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Wendell Phillips and the other old stagers, I could not observe that they ever expected or hoped to get out of the business. I don't want to get wedded to it as they are. Livy thinks we can live on a very moderate sum, and that we'll not need to lecture. I know very well that she can live on a small allowance, but I am not so sure about myself. I can't scare her by reminding her that her father's family expenses are $40,000 a year, because she produces the documents at once, to show that precious little of this outlay is on her account. But I must not commence writing about Livy, else I shall never stop. There isn't such another little piece of perfection in the world as she is. My time has become so short now that I doubt if I get to California this summer. If I manage to buy into a paper, I think I will visit you a while, and not go to California at all. I shall know something about it after my next trip to Hartford. We all go there on the Elzareth, the whole family, to attend a wedding, on the 17th. I am offered an interest in a Cleveland paper which would pay me $2,300 to $2,500 a year, and a salary added of $3,000. The salary is fair enough, but the interest is not large enough, and so I must look a little further. The Cleveland folks say they can be induced to do a little better by me, and urge me to come out and talk business. But it don't strike me I feel little or no inclination to go. I believe I haven't anything else to write, and it is bedtime. I want to write to Orion, but I keep putting it off. I keep putting everything off. Day after day Livy and I are together all day long, and until 10 at night, and then I feel dreadfully sleepy. If Orion will bear with me and forgive me, I will square up with him yet. I will even let him kiss Livy. My love to Molly and Annie and Sammy and all. Goodbye. Affectionately, Sam. It is curious, with his tendency to optimism and general expansion of futures, that he says nothing of the possible sales of the new book, or of his expectations in that line. It was issued in July, and by June the publishers must have had promising advance orders from their canvassers. But apparently he includes none of these chickens in his financial forecast. Even when the book had been out a full month, and was being shipped at the rate of several hundreds a day, he makes no reference to it in a letter to his sister, other than to ask if he has not received a copy. This, however, was a Mark Twain peculiarity. Writing was his trade. The returns from it seldom excited him. It was only when he drifted into strange and untried fields that he began to chase rainbows, to blow iridescent bubbles, and count unmined gold. To Mrs. Moffat, in St. Louis, Buffalo, August 20, 1869. My dear sister, I have only time to write a line. I got your letter this morning and mailed it to Livy. She will be expecting me tonight, and I am sorry to disappoint her so, but then I couldn't well get away. I will go next Saturday. I have bundled up Livy's picture, and will try and recollect to mail it tomorrow. It is a porcelain type, and I think you will like it. I am sorry I never got to St. Louis, because I may be too busy to go for a long time. But I have been busy all the time, and St. Louis is clear out of the way, and remote from the world and all ordinary routes of travel. You must not place too much weight upon this idea of moving the capital from Washington. St. Louis is in some respects a better place for it than Washington, though there isn't more than a toss-up between the two after all. One is dead, and the other in a trance. Washington is in the center of population and business, while St. Louis is far removed from both. And you know there is no geographical center anymore. The railroads and telegraph have done away with all that. It is no longer a matter of sufficient importance to be gravely considered by thinking men. The only centers now are narrowed down to those of intelligence, capital, and population. As I said before, Washington is the nearest to those, and you don't have to paddle across a river on ferry boats of a pattern popular in the Dark Ages to get to it, nor have to clamber up vilely paved hills in rascally omnibuses along with a herd of all sorts of people after you are there. Secondly, the removal of the capital is one of those old regular reliable dodges that are the bread and meat of backcountry congressmen. It is agitated every year. It always has been, it always will be. It is not new in any respect. Thirdly, the capital has cost $40,000,000 already, and lacks a good deal of being finished, yet. There are single stones in the Treasury building and a good many of them that cost $27,000 apiece, and millions were spent in the construction of that, and the Patent Office and the other great government buildings. To move to St. Louis, the country must throw away $100 million of capital invested in those buildings, and go right to work to spend $100 million on new buildings in St. Louis. Shall we ever have a Congress, a majority of whose members are hopelessly insane? Probably not. But it is possible, unquestionably such a thing is possible. Only I don't believe it will happen in our time, and I am satisfied the capital will not be moved until it does happen. But if St. Louis would donate the ground and the buildings, it would be a different matter. No, Pamela, I don't see any good reason to believe you or I will ever see the capital moved. I have twice instructed the publishers to send you a book. It was the first thing I did long before the proofs were finished. Write me if it is not yet done. Livy says we must have you all at our marriage, and I say we can't. It will be at Christmas or New Year's, when such a trip across the country would be equivalent to murder and arson and everything else. And it would cost $500, an amount of money she don't know the value of now, but will before a year is gone. She grieves over it, poor little rascal, but it can't be helped. She must wait a while, till I am firmly on my legs, and then she shall see you. She says her father and mother will invite you, just as soon as the wedding date is definitely fixed, anyway, and she thinks that's bound to settle it. But the ice and snow, and the long hard journey, and the injudiciousness of laying out any money except what we are obliged to part with while we are so much in debt, settles the case differently. For it is a debt. Mr. Langdon is just as good as bound for $25,000 for me, and has already advanced half of it in cash. I wrote and asked whether I had better send him my note, or a due bill, or how he would prefer to have the indebtedness made of record, and he answered every other topic in the letter pleasantly but never replied to that at all. Still, I shall give my note into the hands of his business agent here, and pay him the interest as it falls due. We must owe slow. We are not in the Cleveland Herald. We are 100,000 times better off, but there isn't so much money in it. Remainder missing. In spite of the immediate success of his book, a success the like of which had scarcely been known in America, Mark Twain held himself to be not a literary man, but a journalist. He had no plans for another book. As a newspaper owner and editor, he expected, with his marriage, to settle down and devote the rest of his life to Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.